Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have Boston University's 19th Great Debate, presented by the College of Communication. Modeled after the Cambridge and Oxford University Union Society's public discussions, the Great Debate brings together alumni, faculty, and students in a lively but collegial forum to discuss current issues in communication and public affairs. Based on the tradition of audience-centered parliamentary debate, it involves a series of speeches alternating for and against the topic and includes audience participation, as members may comment prior to the panel's rebuttals. The audience then decides the outcome of the debate by voting with their feet and moving to the side of the room representing their decision. Tonight's topic is, does overseas outsourcing hurt the U.S. economy? Speaking for the affirmative will be Thea Lee, Chief International Economist in the Public Policy Department of the AFL-CIO, and Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Speaking for the negative will be Jerry Jasinkowski, President of the Manufacturing Institute, and Daniel Dresner, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. Tonight's moderator is Boston University Journalism Department Chairman and former longtime ABC News correspondent, Robert Zelnick.
Good evening and welcome to the 19th in the series of Boston University Great Debates. The question tonight is, does overseas outsourcing hurt the U.S. economy? It's a difficult question and triggers many others. Which jobs, if any, are being lost? Do cost savings provide companies with the opportunity to expand, thereby creating new jobs? And what sort of social accounting does one employ where the pain may be narrowly applied, say, among the community of job losers, and the benefits diffuse, say, among a decentralized community of consumers paying less for the product? And are there social and many argue environmental costs to outsourcing abroad, which are hard to glean from corporate balance sheets? On the other hand, is someone trying to repeal the venerable law of comparative advantage, which leaves it to the marketplace to allocate the distribution of labor and capital? These sound like interesting questions, and if I could answer any of them, I would today be lecturing on economics rather than listening as others debate the subject of economic importance. So I'll yield to the experts, and let me introduce them to you now. Arguing in the affirmative, that is, that overseas outsourcing hurts the U.S., are Thea Lee, the Chief International Economist in the Public Policy Department of the AFL-CIO, Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Arguing in the negative are Jerry Jasinkowski, President of the Manufacturing Institute of the National Association of Manufacturers, and that's an organization that he headed for 15 years. Daniel Dresner, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago and author of an influential article on outsourcing in the Foreign Affairs Journal. The time rules are as follows. The lead debaters of each side will speak for 15 minutes. Then the supporting debaters will speak for 10 minutes each. Then I'll ask the House to divide. We'll vote. I'll declare a winner. Debaters, I'm going to ring the bell once when you have a minute left in your presentation, and again when you have no time left. When I ring it that second time, please complete your sentence and repair. With that, I'm going to turn the program over to the debaters. The question again is, does overseas outsourcing hurt the U.S. economy? Our first speaker, economist Thea Lee.
Thank you, Professor Zelnick. And thanks to all of you for coming out tonight. Good evening. It's a real pleasure and an honor to be here. Does overseas outsourcing hurt the U.S. economy? Certainly, when multinational corporations shift decent-paying jobs offshore to produce goods and services for the U.S. market, without regard to any consideration beyond short-term cost savings, Yes, this hurts the U.S. economy. And it hurts it in several different levels. In the very immediate sense, obviously, there's the loss of good jobs. We saw the jobs leave first in the manufacturing sector. We've lost almost 2.7 million manufacturing jobs just in the last couple of years, but this has been a process going on for several decades. And when the manufacturing jobs left, they told us, don't worry, because our comparative advantages in services and high tech will do fine. We're going to replace those jobs with better jobs. But now what we're starting to see is that the outsourcing is hitting white-collar jobs, high-tech jobs, professional jobs, moving up the income and the education ladder to impact many, many more workers in the U.S. economy. And the number of jobs is not the key factor, in fact, but it is the impact on wages of overseas outsourcing. If the whole point of outsourcing is, in fact, to undermine the wages and the bargaining power of American workers, we shouldn't be surprised when the impact is to destroy the middle-class wage structure in the United States. And it's important to note that it's not just those workers who lose their jobs whose wages are affected by overseas outsourcing. It's all those others who are in competition with them, that you impact the labor market at the margin, even when a relatively small number of jobs leaves. But more than jobs and wages, in the longer term, there are bigger impacts and maybe more worrisome impacts on the U.S. economy. The first is that the U.S. could lose its technological edge as we move overseas processes that we used to do here, some of the technology which we transfer abroad is paid for by U.S. tax dollars. The research is done by government institutions. Multinational corporations put some of their best jobs, engineering jobs, computer software programming jobs in other countries. They're incentivizing students in other countries to invest in their education and higher education, not students here. And as that process happens, I think students here wonder, what's the point of going through the pain of an engineering degree or a PhD if that job, too, can be outsourced? Secondly, the outsourcing contributes to the unsustainable and very large trade deficits that the U.S. economy is suffering. We had a $618 billion trade deficit last year. That's almost 6% of our GDP, and it's a rate which I think even free trade economists concede is not healthy or sustainable for the U.S. economy. What that higher trade deficit does is to put downward pressure eventually on the U.S. dollar, which will again erode living standards, but it also increases our national indebtedness. We're borrowing $618 billion a year from the rest of the world in order to sustain a consumption habit that is way beyond what we're producing. We consume $618 billion more worth of goods and services than we're able to produce. That's not a trend that we can continue indefinitely. And the question is, at what point does that kick in? But as we increase our international indebtedness, we also cede the future income from the financial resources. We sell off financial assets and real assets to governments and private investors from other countries. The third piece of the long-term impact is we undermine our own tax base. If American companies are creating jobs in other countries, those folks are paying taxes to those governments, not to ours. We're starving our own public sector, the resources we need for education, for hospitals, for roads, for infrastructure. Again, undermining our ability to keep up the technological edge. And finally, unregulated outsourcing without any concern for the long-term impact threatens our national security. As we grow overly dependent on other countries, possibly hostile countries, for key military and economic supplies that we can no longer produce here in the United States, we put our fate in the hands of other countries. And we maybe will undermine our ability to fight wars in the future if we can no longer produce the supplies that we need. And that's happening in areas like smart bombs that the last rare earth magnet company was sold to China and moved offshore. It's happened in the area of ammunition, where we don't have enough bullets anymore to supply our troops. It's happened in the area of uniforms. So this is not a hypothetical, but a real impact that could that needs to be kept in mind. But I wanted to make two broad points about the outsourcing debate. And that is that, first of all, we ask the question, does outsourcing hurt the U.S. economy? Well, the U.S. economy is not a single monolithic entity. It's made up of a lot of people. You could talk about economic growth, but I don't think that's the only or the most interesting economic factor we need to consider. So we need to look at the winners and losers, and I think that's a more important question. Economists tend to fudge this question by saying that the aggregate benefits from outsourcing outweigh the aggregate losses. And that may or may not be the case. But I think a different question, and one that's also important to ask, is what are the numbers of winners and losers? And do the number of losers outweigh the winners? And maybe by a lot. And those are the questions that are more important. I want to talk about a little bit more in detail, even in the context of neoclassical trade theory, which predicts that both countries win from international trade, from freer trade. It doesn't actually tell you, neoclassical trade theory doesn't tell you that there are more winners than losers in a country. And if, in fact, we don't tax the winners to compensate the losers, that's simply a hypothetical, it doesn't happen in today's economy, then it is relevant, certainly relevant to politicians, if you're talking about a policy that is going to hurt two-thirds of the American workforce and help a very small number of the most elite owners of corporations. If everybody else is being impacted negatively, that's certainly something that's relevant to be taken into account, especially since we're not taking the appropriate policy steps to redress the inequities that are brought about through outsourcing. In fact, we're doing the opposite. All of our national policies today are, in fact, exacerbating income inequality, whether it's tax policy, health care, or the destruction of the social safety net. The second key broad issue is that there isn't one single kind of outsourcing. All outsourcing is not created equal. And some forms are clearly more harmful than others. Some outsourcing is necessary. We can obtain items that we don't or can't or choose not to produce domestically. That's obviously something that we're going to continue doing. Trade, investment, international investment, and immigration are permanent features of a modern economy. So we argue that outsourcing, as it's currently constituted, is bad for the U.S. economy. We're not saying that there are no circumstances under which some shifting of production isn't necessary or desirable. What we're saying is that the current set of policies that our policymakers have put in place to regulate outsourcing and international trade and investment are inadequate and have failed us. And we could do a better job there, and that we need to change the policies around outsourcing in order to spread the benefits more equally and in order to mitigate some of the negative effects. If the point of outsourcing is simply to seek out the weakest, most vulnerable workers, the most craven, corrupt governments, and the natural resources that are most easy to deplete, that's clearly going to have a negative impact, not just on the U.S. economy, but on the global economy. So the different forms of outsourcing really make a difference. So I would argue that our own policymakers have failed us. And I think it's also important to note that this isn't simply an issue of corporations behaving badly. Governments make rules. Governments set out the framework of policies within which corporations work. And to the extent that our rules are inadequate, the responsibility is on our policymakers to do a policy that isn't just about multinational corporate profits, but also takes into account human rights, workers' rights, the environment, the strength of communities, social programs, things that we value as a society and that have been undermined by the outsourcing trend. But we need our policymakers to ask a different question. What is the necessary framework of policies for U.S. producers and workers to compete successfully in the global economy? We don't have it today. Whether it's our tax policy, our trade policy, our currency policy, our inadequate investment in research and development, education, infrastructure, and health care, on all those fronts, we failed to put in place the policies that would allow us to be winners in the global economy. We, and I mean workers, not just multinational corporations. If everything that can be digitized and done more cheaply moves offshore, what kind of jobs will be left behind? What kind of jobs will you get when you graduate from Boston University? And what is our government strategy for keeping the good jobs at home? You can bet that Indian policymakers and Chinese policymakers and Brazilian policymakers are taking into account. They're trying to think about how to keep good jobs at home. It's our policymakers who are stuck in some outdated, unrealistic, failed textbook set of free trade policies that simply don't apply to today's world. If we look at the trends of jobs, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has projected what the fastest growing jobs or the largest job growth over the next 10 years will be. And in the top 20 categories of the occupations with the largest job growth, Only 3 out of 20 required more than an associate's degree. The others were things that required only short-term or moderate-term on-the-job training. Let me read to you some of them. The 3 that required an associate's or better degree: registered nurses, post-secondary teachers, general and operations managers. What are the others? Retail sales, customer service, food prep, cashiers, janitors, waiters, nursing aides, truck drivers, receptionists, security guards, office clerks, teacher assistants, sales reps, home health aides, personal and home care aides, truck drivers of delivery services, and landscaping and groundkeeping services. Okay, some of those are decent jobs. Certainly those are jobs that need to be done. But here's the question. Is the U.S. going to build a future as a global economic leader on the basis of all of us shining each other's shoes and changing each other's bedpans if we don't have the external sector right, if we aren't able to make anything that the rest of the world wants to buy, and we don't have the policies in place that allow us to do that successfully today? So I would argue to you that the outsourcing trend is destroying ladders of upward mobility in our economy as we offshore production for home markets and outsource our knowledge jobs. And there's a difference between free trade, as Adam Smith and David Ricardo described it, and as you probably studied it in Econ 101, and what we're now experiencing, what we call outsourcing. Free trade is the exchange of goods across international borders. You remove tariffs, you trade more. That model makes several very stringent assumptions. Assumes perfect competition. That is, there's no market power, there's no monopolies, there's no profits. Assumes full employment. Balanced trade, I just told you we had a $618 billion trade deficit. It assumes no externalities, that is to say, no pollution, no violation of workers' rights, nothing that would spill over across borders. It assumes no factor mobility, that capital's not crossing borders and workers aren't crossing borders. It works best in a two-country, two-good, two-factor model. It's not quite as strong the other way. It also assumes that technology is given and fixed, and it's not changing, that everybody has access to the same technology. That's not a part. The strategic acquisition of technological edge is not a part of the free trade model. And comparative advantage in that model is driven by climate and differences in initial factor endowments. If you've got more low-skill labor, then you produce a lot of stuff with low-skill labor. You have a lot of capital, you produce a lot of stuff with capital. This is not the world we live in today. And in fact, on almost every front, this model doesn't describe our world. That if we have different countries that have different levels of social regulation, different levels of environmental regulation, labor protection, do we want the trade model to be one where there's arbitrage between those different social models, that the countries with the highest standards, labor and environmental standards, become disadvantaged in a global economy because we haven't written those rules into the global trading system? So that the outsourcing, different from the kind of clinical free trade, is about capital mobility and about capital crossing borders to engage in labor arbitrage and the arbitrage of social regulations. And what the impact is that in the absence of a different set of trading rules where we can protect workers' rights and environmental standards, we can put a priority on democracy and human rights and say these are the things that we care about. In the absence of that, free trade, outsourcing, offshore outsourcing, in fact, creates a race to the bottom, where the worst players in the global economy, in fact, become the winners. And I would argue to you this is not healthy for the U.S. economy. It's not healthy for American workers, farmers, even for consumers, because consumers tend not to be the big beneficiaries. And in fact, we can put in place a whole set of policies that aren't about banning private sector outsourcing, but that do change the equation, whether it's changing our tax policy so we don't reward outsourcing, changing our trade policy so we protect workers' rights and environmental standards, changing our government procurement policies so that our tax dollars can be used to create good jobs at home, and making sure that we are, in fact, protecting consumers as offshore outsourcing goes on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. And our first debater on the negative side of the proposition is Jerry Jasinowski.
Thank you very much, Professor Zelnick, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted to be here with you. Offshore outsourcing has been blamed for everything. It's been blamed for taking millions of jobs, destroying our manufacturing base, taking our technology. If you listen to Lou Dobbs on the television night after night, it is the destruction and threat to the way we live. I would argue that not only is that terribly exaggerated, it's silly intellectually that there are not many facts or analyses that you can make that show that outsourcing hurts the American economy in a major way, that outsourcing, in fact, has a number of very important positives, and that by taking us away from understanding its proper proportion, we don't focus on what is important for jobs. Now, what do you care about? Why are you here tonight? Let me ask to begin with, just so I get a sense of the audience, how many of you think that offshore outsourcing is a big problem that can hurt the American economy a lot? You don't have to agree with Thea's argument. Just give me a sense if you think it's a really big problem. We should just focus on it as a high priority. Okay, well, I think there's quite a lot. I'm actually surprised it's not more. If you look at the public polls, 70% of the American people think it's a terrible problem. So this looks like it's more evenly split, and that should make for a much more interesting debate in terms of listening to what we have to say. Let me first of all say that outsourcing does not have any significant big economic effects on jobs. All the studies show that offshore outsourcing tends to cause about 1% of the employment losses we face. It's a couple of 100,000 jobs a year. That's not insignificant, and I'll come back to that, but it's relatively small in an economy that has approaching 140 million jobs. And every study has shown that. The GAO has shown that. There have been studies in California. If you look at the Forrester research, and I will say that Dan Detzner has done a terrific job in this foreign affairs article that you should read it, you'll see that they project 3.3 million jobs lost to outsourcing. But it's over like 7 or 8 years. And so the job loss is modest, probably 100,000 to 200,000 a year on a workforce of 130 million. The second thing to realize is there are a lot of positives to outsourcing. Outsourcing has been going on forever, for decades. And the reason it's done by companies is because it allows them to ship out things they don't do well, focus on their core business, be more productive, and be more competitive. It turns out that it goes on to domestic companies far more than foreign companies. 90% of the outsourcing done by companies goes to domestic companies and their small companies and small manufacturers. The rest of it that does go tends to make companies more efficient, and very often that causes them to, in fact, increase employment. It turned out that Delta Airlines outsourced about 1,000 jobs for call centers, ended up saving $25 million, and it ended up hiring another 1,500 people in marketing and sales. The studies done by the Institute for International Economics shows that it increases our country's GNP, so that's another positive. And it tends also to connect us to the rest of the world, which is a theme I want to come back to again and again. Outsourcing is a positive way to link to India and to China, and we don't want to be in a situation where we think the global economy is something to fear, that foreigners are something that we ought to fear, that outsourcing is a demon. We want to look at it as something that's part of the practical global economy. Now, having said all that, outsourcing ought not to be dismissed. The couple of 100,000 jobs lost are real people, and we ought to do all we can to retrain those people. So we ought to fund trade adjustment assistance, which is a government program for those people who are truly impacted by outsourcing, and we ought to focus on improved training and education. I would argue, in fact, also, that if there are true national security issues, if Thea is right that we've got to fear about giving away technology, then let's not outsource it. We shouldn't do that. But that's got to be, you know, we don't want to outsource NORAD. We don't want to outsource all of our national defense. We don't want to outsource even things with very high technology. But there are a lot of other things you can do that are not going to threaten technology. And then the other thing that we ought to do is focus on education and training. Now, why are you here? You're here to get an education. Why do you want an education? Because you want to improve your quality of life. You want to get a good job and make a few bucks. And you want to learn. You're just here because you want to learn. Now, all of those are very positive things. And I would submit you can't do it unless you think of yourself as in a global world. Anne-Marie, his mother's French. We spent a lot of time in France. I wish we spent more. Anne-Marie's learning French. She's worked very hard on that. And I think that the little things like learning languages are very important. I've just been to China 3 times in the last several months, and it was fascinating and interesting, and I found it a great enrichment. Now, I have been battling the Chinese for years on unfair trade practices. And we ought to focus a lot on being sure that they don't counterfeit, that their exchange rate is fair. So we should be tough with the Chinese, but that doesn't mean we've got to ignore them or not have economic relationships with them. So that's what we ought to do in terms of dealing with the problem. And then I would submit we ought to, in addition to education and training, focus on some of these other problems in the global economy so that we can be engaged and be engaged in a meaningful way. The first and most important, again, is education and training. I asked you why you're here. We don't have an education system that's adequate for the global world. K through 12 is not accountable. We have a shortage of engineers. China produces 5 times the number of engineers that we do, and the list goes on and on. I just did a survey of businesses and asked them about jobs. 30% said they had jobs they couldn't fill because there weren't people adequately skilled in this country. So let me tell you, if there's something you want to worry about, you want to worry about your own education, you want to worry about the education of your state, and you want to worry about the education of your country, don't worry about outsourcing. Now, if there's something else you want to worry about a level playing field. Let's be tough with the Chinese. Force them to have market exchange rates. Don't allow them to counterfeit. Have them support human rights and all the other things we should have. You want to worry about something? Worry about the cost of doing business in this country. 2% of our GDP goes for lawsuits, and it's a very, very big cost. Healthcare, which is a great advantage we have in this country, the cost is growing at double-digit rates. It will soon eat up the entire federal budget. We've got to bring healthcare costs under control. Energy prices have doubled in the last year. And as a result, we're in a situation where we're more and more energy dependent. Those things in education and training are the things we ought to be worrying about if we're worrying about jobs for the future and having a high-quality life. So I would submit offshore outsourcing does not have any significant negative effects on the American economy. It is, on balance, a positive. It tends to improve the competitiveness of firms. It causes increases in jobs in most cases. To the extent there is an offshore outsourcing problem, let's, in fact, focus on what we really need to do to deal with the people who are affected. Let's give them assistance. Let's give them education and training. Let's not outsource anything that's for national security. And after we've done all that, let's sit back, take a deep breath, and ask ourselves what we really should be worrying about.
A the final debater for the affirmative side of the argument is Lori Wallach.
Thank you all for your interest and your time. What I'm going to do is take on some of the arguments that we've already just heard about why offshoring is theoretically not a problem for the U.S. economy. Because indeed, the data, the research shows it is a serious problem already. But more importantly, the future projections of where we're heading indicate that we're going to head towards a much larger problem with the offshoring trend. Now, I want to clear up myself what we're talking about. As Thea said, we're not talking about free trade, where you send goods back and forth. We're not even talking about foreign direct investment, which is where you take money, you invest it in another country to produce stuff for that country. What we're talking about here is the one and only export that the U.S. has that's increasing, that's exporting U.S. jobs. Unfortunately, that's our big growth export. What we're talking about is jobs, production of goods and services that are supposed to be consumed inside the U.S., the jobs to create those goods and services being sent overseas, away from the U.S., to lower wage facilities with the intention of bringing the good or service back for consumption by a U.S. consumer who is no longer necessarily the person who's going to be producing that. That is what Morgan Stanley's chief economist calls global labor arbitrage. More or less, geographic borders have broken down and we're trading people's ability to do a job. Any job that does not require physical presence is subject to offshoring. If you look at the difference in wages, for instance, folks here who are thinking of a career in information technology, a person who starts not as a basic programmer or a tester, but actually a designer, $70,000, $75,000, $80,000 now. In India, a very hardworking, smart person with a PhD will have that same job, if they're lucky, for $20,000. Now, that's not a job that physically has to stay here. So what company is going to pay you the amount that you need to live here to do the same job that someone who has better education and perhaps more experience can do for $20,000? You have to think of what jobs don't actually require physical presence. Basically, almost all of them. So if you're going to be a plumber or a nurse, you're in good shape. And I'm being a little sarcastic because there are obviously jobs besides that. But the numbers that actually are causing the concerns are the projections of the future. And that is where the big fight is. So the University of California at Berkeley has projected, they looked at factors of different kinds of jobs, and they qualified different kinds of jobs according to how susceptible they were to offshoring. And they then gave them scores according to how much presence you had to have, how much you had to interrelate to other people, etc. They found of the categories of jobs in the U.S. economy, 14 million are in the highest level of susceptibility to offshoring, which is a number, frankly, more conservative than what, as we heard, Business Week reported, which was 1 in 3 current jobs in the private sector. 1 in 3. Now, Mr. Jasnowski is saying that we shouldn't get our knickers in a knot just because we've already exported 5% of our information technology jobs, which when they're going out, 2,000 a year, the number right now is 5%. The problem is that the consulting firms that the corporations use, like McKinsey, are predicting that job exports will increase 30 to 40% per year, each year growing out. Which is to say that the future numbers make this a growing problem. Of the 14 million jobs that Berkeley found were most susceptible, those jobs were paying 20 to 60% higher than the average U.S. wage. So there's actually good jobs. Now we've heard a couple of times about the Institute for International Economics. That's a think tank in Washington that's funded a lot by companies. And they've done the study that claims that we're going to create jobs, growth, etc. There's just one little hitch with their study. They do a balance of how many jobs go out, how much money you save, therefore you create new jobs. The big catch is this. They presume the money goes to be reinvested back into creating new jobs and into your company. The reality is the period that they did the research and used that assumption, the reality was that actually corporate profits, where the money really went that was saved, paying somebody $20,000 instead of $70,000, went into corporate profits, which went up at that period 61%, at the point that wages went up 7% in the particular sectors studied. What's happening with wages? Because as Thea said, it's not about the total number of jobs. It's about the wages of the work that's available across the economy and the composition of what kind of jobs are out there that make our economy. The wage issue is a real crisis. Because when you have global job arbitrage, what it literally means is you're in competition directly on the wage level with people who are willing to do the same work you are for an amount of money you can't live on in our country. So a factoid that is one of those driving the crisis of policy in Washington and offshoring is that right now the median wage, i.e. where the biggest bulge of the population is, in real terms, adjusted for inflation, in the U.S. is stuck at 1972 levels. And guys, you've got it worse, because if you look just at men, you're below 1972 levels, the median real wage. It's only because so many women have entered the workforce and they're actually catching up that if you net both genders, it's at 1972 levels. If you look at the Labor Department's information about what happens to workers whose job is offshored when they get a replacement job, because this is the so-called churn of jobs we hear about, the average wage is 85% lower. And then we heard that, well, all right, some pressure on wages by competing with people willing to work for very little, but prices will come down. Ladies and gentlemen, I come from a consumer group. We have to look into this price argument. There's just one big problem. When you look at the data, there are a couple of places where you can see offshoring has decreased prices. If you look at, though, the consumer price index of the basket of goods that most consumers actually consume, ironically, in the area where we have offshored the most, there is not a big drop in prices. And in fact, in some areas, if you can imagine food production, the U.S. is right now about to become a net importer of food. Can anyone imagine that? This year we're going to become a net importer of food. Consumer prices during the period we went from a huge net exporter to almost a net importer, which will happen this year, food prices went up 23%. It's coming from a much cheaper source, and we consumers are paying more. Which gets from the wages and prices to the issue of what kind of jobs. Now, it's interesting to hear Mr. Jasinowski's comment about a company that can't find workers, because I pulled the data on unemployment in the areas that are most susceptible to offshoring. And we all know where the actual unemployment rate is, 5 and change. Engineering right now, 7.7% unemployment rate. A lot of engineers who can't find a job, higher than national average. Software designers, 7.5%. In the information technology market, just FYI, the jobs shrank from 2001 to 2004, 2,000%. That's supposed to be after the economic recovery. But still, that sector is shrinking. Finally, Thea went through the list of jobs that are the ones slated for the most growth. Not exactly what you're going to college to take those jobs. Important jobs, someone's got to do them. But those are the jobs that are bringing down the wage levels. After Mr. Jasinowski said this isn't a big problem, and it's not going to cause any kind of job or wage loss, he then said, in fact, it's good for us and good for the economy. And there are two sets of issues that clearly have the data showing that's not the case. The wage data we've already seen, as well as incredible increase in wage inequality. Now, it is both a prediction, and now there's empirical evidence, that when you liberalize trade and when you shift jobs offshore, you increase the inequality of distribution of wages across the economy. That's happening. In fact, if anyone remembers a year ago, the New York Times Sunday Magazine cover, the biggest increase in U.S. wage inequality since the robber baron age. That is neither good for the most of us who end up on the bottom end of that, nor for the social stability of our country. And then there are the consumer problems. There are privacy issues of offshoring. In the U.S., your information having to do with your medical information, your blood tests, any kind of illness you have, your financial information with the bank, your tax information, all of that is privacy protected in ways that if your privacy is violated, there's significant fines. When that information is sent overseas to be processed, the rules don't follow. Europe has a system to protect consumers. The U.S. doesn't. And then the final argument that needs to be raised is that the very theoretical basis underlying the notion that offshoring would be good is crumbling. And I want to end with a wonderful quote from Professor Paul Samuelson, the grandfather of free trade theory. Professor Samuelson notes that it's a, quote, popular polemic, end quote, that more free trade and liberalization is always a benefit to the economy. But he notes that's not so, because currently the boundaries in labor markets are disappearing, and there is a point at which lower costs are overcome by yet lower wages, he says. If you don't believe that changes, that changes the average wage level in America, you must believe in the tooth fairy. Thank you.
I want to address first Ms. Lee's point about national security, the problem about outsourcing leading to, you know, excessive interdependence and potentially destabilizing national security. And I have to admit, when she did that, I got a very powerful sense of deja vu. The reason is that 15 years ago, when I would have been sitting there, the big concern was about Japan. The big concern was about Japanese economic growth and technological supremacy overtaking the United States. There was a book that was published called The Japan That Can Say No, where the chairman of the Sony Corporation intimated that perhaps Japan won't be selling semiconductor chips to be targeting U.S., you know, for U.S. ICBMs, and that therefore maybe they would sell them to, let's say, the Soviets. Now, obviously, this didn't happen. And this should be an example of, you know, a fear that is occasionally brought up but, in fact, does not actually take place. In fact, I would argue outsourcing brings massive national security benefits. The first and most important is poverty reduction. In the last 25 years, the greatest amount of poverty reduction in world history has taken place in China and India. And the reason is precisely because those economies have decided to open themselves up to the global economy. And as a result of doing that, they're more stable. There was an interesting essay, op-ed, that Senator Chuck Schumer, godfather of economics apparently, wrote arguing about why the law of comparative advantage was no longer applicable. And I want to read what he said. First, new political stability is allowing capital and technology to flow far more freely around the world. Second, strong educational systems are producing tens of millions of intelligent, motivated workers in the developing world, particularly in India and China, who are as capable as the most highly educated workers in the developed world. Last, inexpensive, high-bandwidth communication make it feasible for large workforces to be located and effectively managed anywhere. So in other words, the real problem about offshore outsourcing is that there's more political stability in the world. People are better educated, and they can talk to each other more. Dear God, the horror, the horror. That is exactly what we want to see in the global economy. In the long term, China and India are going to grow, regardless of what we do about offshore outsourcing. And there's a fairly valid question you want to ask. Do you want to see China and India to view the United States as a friend or a foe, as a country that retarded or helped their economic progress 20, 30, 40 years from now? Because that's an important foreign policy question. Another important foreign policy question is Pakistan. How do you get Pakistan to turn from a country of squabbling tribes and fundamentalist religion into a country that actually cares about economic growth more? The answer, among others, is outsourcing. And finally, with regard to interdependence, international relations theory has demonstrated that the greatest causes for peace is the promoting of democracy, the promoting of international organizations, and, yes, economic interdependence. So, in fact, I will very happily take the national security benefits that come from offshore outsourcing. The second point I want to talk about in response to what Ms. Lee and others have said is about the cost of offshore outsourcing. I think critics have vastly exaggerated the cost, and in part taking, you know, a small effect offshore outsourcing and equating it with something that has a much more powerful effect. For example, Ms. Lee argued that offshore outsourcing contributes to the massive current account deficit. And let me count myself among those who is somewhat disturbed about the size of the current account deficit, except that offshore outsourcing doesn't have anything to do with it. The trend in terms of services between 1997 and 2002 in business, professional, and technical services, the areas that presumably offshore outsourcing is supposed to be really the most powerful, the U.S. ran a surplus, an increasing surplus. Its surplus increased by $4.2 billion over those 5 years. So this has nothing to do with the trade deficit. Overall, in terms of services, the U.S. consistently runs a surplus in terms of trade. So, in fact, if you want to worsen the trade deficit, retarding offshore outsourcing is just a great way to do it. Second, in terms of high-tech jobs, Ms. Wallach, you know, mentioned some statistics. I want to mention some as well. In 2004, the jobless rate for those who hold MAs in either computer engineering or math was a whopping 3.3%. All right. Presumably the jobs that are supposed to be rushing overseas right now, that unemployment rate is lower than the national average. The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects that jobs in the IT field are going to grow at 3 times the rate of the overall economic increase in jobs in the United States over the next 10 years. And finally, when you take a look at sort of what the economy is doing now, or particularly a couple of years ago in terms of slack job growth, you can't necessarily assume, and it would be dangerous to assume, that offshore outsourcing is responsible for slack job growth. There were a couple of other things that happened. There was a dot-com crash. There were some corporate scandals. And there were some planes flown into the World Trade Center. Right? Those are some massive shocks to the system. It's not shocking that job growth was relatively slow. It doesn't have a lot to do with offshore outsourcing. On the privacy question that Ms. Wallach raised about concerns about whether or not your medical information or other information might go overseas, I would respectfully suggest that really this isn't a question of regulation. This is a question of technology. If someone can hack into Paris Hilton's cell phone in the United States, I really don't think we need to worry about outsourcing stuff to Pakistan to worry about the invasion of privacy. This isn't a question about offshore outsourcing. It's a question of technology. And furthermore, it's worth pointing out that in terms of those who talk about whether or not offshore outsourcing destroys jobs in the United States, it's often the case that offshore outsourcing doesn't destroy jobs so much as a substitute for automation. In other words, to be clear, yes, it's possible that offshore outsourcing might lead to a job destroyed here. But the alternative isn't necessarily to keep the job here. The alternative is that the job gets automated. What's going on here is that technological innovation is leading to a lot of jobs that were previously considered high-skilled that is getting segmented into simpler and simpler tasks, which has happened since time immemorial. It's the same reason why manufacturing jobs have disappeared. Manufacturing jobs have gone away over the last 25 years. There's no question about that. Interestingly enough, manufacturing output in the United States has increased by 50%. This is because technological innovation has made the country much more productive. And if you think all of those jobs are going to China, China's manufacturing sector suffered a decline of 15% of its job force over the last 10 years as well, again, because of technological innovation. And finally, I want to make clear that Ms. Lee pointed out there was a difference between talking about whether or not offshore outsourcing was good for the U.S. economy versus policies with regard to offshore outsourcing. I actually agree with Ms. Lee on a fair number of those policies in terms of supporting education, supporting R&D, and extending trade adjustment service to service workers as well as manufacturing workers. There's no question those policies could be remedied more. I don't know they have a great deal to do with offshore outsourcing. I disagree on some other ways to fix it. And in fact, anything that potentially retards offshore outsourcing by functioning as implicitly a form of protectionism makes the economies worse, and furthermore, is far worse for the economy and destroys jobs. The last couple of years, we've seen two efforts to sort of high-profile protectionism to sort of protect American jobs. The application of steel tariffs in 2002 and the persistent use of sugar quotas to prevent the importation of sugar. Now, those protection barriers have without question reduced job loss in both sugar-producing industries and in steel-making industries. But the Institute for International Economics has shown that they've destroyed a lot more jobs in steel-using sectors and among candy manufacturers. So as a result, the question you have to ask is, are those policies going to create more jobs? No, they're going to destroy more of them. And I think the irony is, in terms of talking about the fear of no more job creation, it's worth pointing out that most of the jobs that were talked about, software engineering, computer programming, didn't exist 15 years ago. The question to ask in terms of what are the new jobs going to be, I'll be honest, I don't know. But if I had told you 20 years ago that the new job sectors were going to be in terms of software engineering or web design or anything like that, you wouldn't have known what I was necessarily talking about. And so it's very careful, you know, it's very dangerous to assume that the only jobs we've got are the jobs that exist now. It is, in some sense, I would say in contrast to what was said before, an economic miracle. That even if jobs disappear in one sector, they are usually created in another. And the fact that U.S. unemployment and the percentage of U.S. workers in the economy are, relatively speaking, all-time highs suggests that the economy is relatively robust. I want to close with 2 points. The first one is that one of the ironies about this is if we take a look at another country that tried protectionism as a way of creating jobs, think about India. India, 15 years ago, thought it had a relatively vital software sector. And it thought the way to create jobs was to mandate that those software producers buy Indian hardware Indian computers in order to produce, in order to develop their software sector. It wasn't until they liberalized, until they could import computers from the United States and elsewhere, that the software sector took off. And finally, I think we have to be careful about those who cry wolf. 35 years ago, the concern was about automation. 15 years ago, the concern was about Japan. 10 years ago, the concern was about downsizing. American jobs have been created ever since then. It's one of the greatest economic engines in world history. We don't want to change it. Thank you.
Well, in the past, we've had a problem when I've asked for the room to divide. Some people just make it out the back quickly. So I'm going to ask you to cast your vote. Those of you who believe that the outsourcing, overseas outsourcing, is a jobs, hurts the U.S. economy, gather to my right. Those of you who believe it does not hurt the U.S. economy and that the team to my left won, gather to my left. And I will declare a winner momentarily. It is the decision here that the affirmative side of the debate is the winning side, and that at least for purposes of this debate, the question was answered in the affirmative that the overseas outsourcing of jobs does hurt the U.S. economy. Thank you all. I hope you found the debate as interesting and instructive as I did. Thank you and good night.
You've been listening to the Boston University College of Communications Great Debate. Tonight's topic was, does overseas outsourcing hurt the U.S. economy? Speaking for the affirmative was Thea Lee, Chief International Economist in the Public Policy Department of the AFL-CIO, and Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Speaking for the negative was Jerry Jasinkowski, President of the Manufacturing Institute, and Daniel Dresner, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Journalism Department Chairman and former longtime ABC News correspondent Robert Zelnick. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Kozeli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.